Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
Talking to whales and searching for life in the universe. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. Scientists are looking in our Earth's oceans to try and communicate with extraterrestrials off this planet. Researchers are studying humpback whales to see how they communicate. The SETI Institute is hopeful understanding how humans may communicate with whales can help shape our plan to search for and make contact with extraterrestrial life. We'll hear from those researchers about those efforts. Then, the existence of extraterrestrials could be confirmed in mere decades. We'll speak with Adam Frank, the author of The Little Book of Aliens, about the journey to finding extraterrestrial life and getting closer to answering the ultimate question, are we alone in the universe? That's ahead on Are We There Yet? In the search for alien life, researchers are looking closer to home and talking to whales. That's the sound of researchers talking to whales. In research conducted under a NOAA and National Marine Fisheries Service permit, Brenda McAllen, a core scientist and unit leader at the California National Primate Research Center, and Fred Sharp, an investigator with the Alaska Whale Foundation, spoke with one humpback whale. That is intriguing to scientists hoping to speak to non-humans off this planet, like Lawrence Doyle, a researcher at the SETI Institute. All three of them join us now to discuss this researcher and what it means in the search for extraterrestrial intelligence. Brenda, Fred, Lawrence, welcome to the show.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. And hopefully there's some aliens listening in too that we haven't detected yet.
I hope this does go over an FM broadcast, so that maybe they are listening. Speaking of aliens, in the search for extraterrestrial life, pardon this question, but why on earth are you looking in the ocean first? Lawrence, do you want to kick us off?
SETI is 6 decades old, and they've been looking for a narrow carrier signal, which is a sign of technology. And what it means is you tune onto a radio channel and you move the dial once, you're on a new radio channel. Well, nature can't do that. You'd have to move the dial 300 times to be off an OH maser in the galaxy. So in other words, nature can't make narrow carrier waves. And that's been used as a criterion now to detect extraterrestrial technology. But it could be that the signals are broadband, and it could be that if and when we get a signal, we'd miss it because we're not examining the message for intelligence. And part of that had to do with not having a definition of intelligence. And so we have been using information theory as a measure, a direct measure of the complexity of the message, and therefore, in some sense, a direct measure of communication intelligence. So in other words, what we can do is first see if it is compatible as a potential intelligent message. And then we can use more in-depth analysis of information theory to see if it does contain the structures of language. In other words, rules that in human language we call syntax, grammar, and so on. So we can actually develop an intelligence filter and broaden the search beyond just narrow carrier wave, but actually ask, is this message intelligent? So what are we doing with humpback whales? Well, they're intelligent. They have communication. They have tools. They're basically put a lot of their information in sound, basically, whereas, say, for example, chimpanzees use gestures and facials and stuff. So we thought we'd start with a creature that was very intelligent and relied heavily on audio to communicate. The analogy is practicing in Antarctica to explore Mars. You find out a lot of things when you try and work in Antarctic ice and under the dry valleys under the ice. And you find out a whole lot of things when you're studying humpback whales and other intelligent species about how unprepared you might have been for contact from space. You're in the presence of a non-human intelligence and you go, wow, I'm glad we encountered that now. We would have missed that.
Fred, let's talk about what we do know about these humpback whales that were studied in in this paper. I know that it is complex. So as succinctly as you can, how do these whales communicate?
Vocalizations are extremely important, as we mentioned. Also, they have some sort of cosmic or alien-like features about their communication in that their sounds are very high velocity. They're very far traveled. By the time they get there, they may have lost some of their actionable intelligence in that if it takes a sound 25 minutes or so to get there to the receiver, but it takes you a week to get there when you travel, it's just simply, you know, we go for that same problem with signals coming in from distant places in that they may be really old. So the whales have to make decisions about, is this actionable intelligence or will the event by the time I get there be over? Whales also have unique forms of communication that terrestrial animals don't really have. Some of those might be their bubble tools that are thought to be an important signaling device. So we're really challenged by using these remarkable animals.
And in this particular study, Brenda, it wasn't just listening for whales, right? It was actually communicating back, right? I mean, talk about the significance of the findings in this particular application of communicating with a non-human species.
So we do both, right? We do actually listen to and collect a lot of data on just the diversity of their vocalizations and trying to decipher, to decode what they're talking about per se in different contexts, because whales have a number of different behaviors that they engage in that we can look at how their vocalizations are used. And we are definitely doing that as well. But one of the tools that we use in studying animal communication is playback studies to probe the system, to understand better what these signals might mean or how these signals are structured. And so that's what we did. We went to Southeast Alaska and we did a number of playback studies, most of which were highly unsuccessful because the whales were busy feeding. But in this particular case, and why this was such a rare event, is that in most playback studies, what happens is you kind of play back vocalizations to a population of animals, and then you try to determine whether or not the population is responding. What was really unique about this particular circumstance is that we actually targeted one whale and had a conversation with that particular whale who was in proximity to where we were doing the playback, but stayed for 20 minutes and exchanged vocalizations with us in a patterned way. In other words, met in sort of the inter-signal interval, which has implications for intent in communicating and exchanging. We did a very controlled experiment where we had a 20-minute pre-playback period where we recorded what was going on. We got nothing. Then the playback period where we had 36 exchanges with this particular whale. We knew it was her vocalizing and she was circling the boat. And then we did a post-playback where there was, again, nothing. So it shows that this particular kind of exchange was intentional between us and Twain.
Fred, is what you garnered from that just the conversation was intentional, or were you able to decipher what was being said back and forth? What was the conversation?
I guess the most important part of the conversation is the whale. And we felt heard. We felt like we knew who the sender and the receiver were. There's still a ton of work to be done in figuring out exactly what is being exchanged. And we have a long ways to go.
Brenda, I've got to imagine, as someone who almost failed high school French, and that's a language that we do know, this is extremely complex work, right? To try to decipher what they're saying. But the fact that there was intentionality and the fact that you were feeling heard is a huge, huge finding in this, right?
I think so. I mean, I've been studying animal communication for over 30 years, and this is the first time, particularly in a wild situation, where I've experienced something like this. It was awe-inspiring to have an animal really respond to us that way. I hope we can replicate it. I mean, that's the plan. And to also go beyond what we were able to do, which was limiting. We didn't have the technology to dynamically change the way that we were playing back the signal other than the timing. So we are now working on developing a system where we can do real record playback in real time with calls that we're receiving in real time and dynamically change them so we can see how the whale responds. Does the whale match what we do? Does the whale do something different? Are there patterns that emerge so that we can begin to use that to understand how they communicate?
And Lawrence, for SETI, why is this so interesting and important in your work?
Well, at a recent conference, I played a humpback whale for making vocalizations for about 2 minutes, a minute and a half maybe. And then I asked the audience, who are all SETI people, is that an intelligent signal? And what if it came from space? And I think they got the idea. Everybody kind of gasped a little bit, which is great, great feeling when you can make a room full of, you know, 100 PhDs gasp. And it was that they realized we had better practice on non-humans on Earth because we need to deprovincialize our thinking. And not just deprovincialize our narrowband carrier wave, you know, the technique, and develop intelligent filters, but we need to start broadening. Intelligence is not the ability to be more human. You know, we have to quit thinking that way. There's all sorts of intelligence on Earth, and until we broaden our thoughts of it, you know, it's in the title of the SETI Institute. So, and yet we're still working out definitions of it. Mm-hmm. But I think it's very important for SETI to embrace this new approach to SETI, because it may not be narrow carrier wave. It may be a broadband signal, in which case we have to look at the message. And then we have to say, is it an intelligent message? Also, we're not going to do that unless we're already thinking that way. So, you know, it's been a while. We've been doing this for a while, but I think we're about to undergo a kind of a revolution in SETI thought mm-hmm. about how to detect intelligence in the universe. So I think it's an essential path. And we may have been missing signals all this time because we haven't taken this step mm-hmm. of defining intelligence.
So essentially, it's not the fact that if we are going to make contact with extraterrestrials, it will be whale sounds. It will be sounds that are not like our own sounds. And that's what makes this such a significant finding.
Yeah. Yeah, it shows. The other thing is that SETI, if we had an Arecibo telescope at the other side of the galaxy, they could communicate with each other. That's how powerful the radar, planetary radar is, and how sensitive the Arecibo telescope was. So it would take a 200,000-year turnover, you know, to send signals. But nevertheless, Arecibos could talk to each other across the galaxy. What we can do with leaks is detect something no more than about 10 light years away. So at the current state of our technology, a leak is unlikely to be detected. So they have to want to point toward us. And one of the things that this is encouraging is that intelligent species, non-human species, will be curious and interested in making contact. And everything we've recently come across says that humpback whales are curious and interested in making contact. We have a paper coming up, Fred's lead author on, and it's about humpback whales blowing bubble rings and sometimes poking their head through them. And the working hypothesis, and what it kind of looks like to a non-biologist, me, is a play invitation like they've suggested.
Mm-hmm. I want to end this conversation with you, Fred, because this is fascinating work that you do. Did you ever think that your work in this field would lead you to helping the SETI Institute search for alien life?
Not in my wildest dreams. But, you know, animal communication, animal behavior studies, I think we're here to help wherever we can. And if that's also part of seeking companion life in the universe, well, let's get on it.
Absolutely fascinating conversation with the three of you. Fred, Brenda, Lawrence, thank you so much for sharing your findings and the work that you do trying to understand what those voices may be.
It was a lot of fun.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you, Brenda.
To be continued.
That was Brenda McCallan, Fred Sharp, and Lawrence Doyle, researchers at the SETI Institute. We'll link to their study on our website. Visit wmfe.org/arewetherayet. Still to come, how close are scientists to getting an answer to the age-old question, are we alone in the universe? That's ahead on Are We There Yet?
Support for Central Florida Public Media comes from Addition Financial, offering their Savings Plus account with a 4% annual percentage yield. Serving Central Floridians since 1937 and was recently named one of Newsweek's best regional credit unions. More at additionfi.com/NPR. Applicable on savings up to $5,000. Rate subject to change, federally insured by NCUA.
You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. The search for life in our universe has been an ongoing exploration and a timeless question dating back thousands of years. But scientists believe that humans are extremely close to making some form of contact with aliens and finding data that proves it all. Here to talk about how scientists are taking the step to find aliens is Adam Frank, an astrophysicist and author of The Little Book of Aliens. Adam, welcome to the show.
It's a real pleasure, Brendan. Thank you for having me on.
So it's The Little Book of Aliens, but it is a big question, right, as to whether or not we are alone in the universe. Why is this such an important question for people like you to answer?
I would say it's the oldest and most important scientific question that we have, or at least certainly one of the oldest. You know, I've been doing astronomy for 30 years, studied everything from stars to how stars form to how planets lose their atmospheres. But the question of life in the universe is one that, you know, you can see the Greeks yelling at each other 2,500 years ago. And then people have been going at each other with just their opinions, man, for the rest of that time. But, you know, really only a few decades ago that we actually had the capacity to start actually carrying forward a search. And the whole point of the book is to let people understand how close we are to actually having real data for the first time, actual data about life, one kind or another, either smart or dumb, on alien planets, which is where we expect aliens to live.
I mean, put it into perspective, like just how close are we to answering that question?
I think within the next 10, 20 to 30 years, we'll have real data that is going to either tell us that we found life of one form or another on a distant alien world, or we're going to start being able to put limits on how prevalent life is by not finding life. But either way, the telescopes that we are building, the James Webb is just at the hairy edge. Like, there's things it can do, and if we get lucky, maybe it will reveal a biosignature. But James Webb is really the first space telescope that can really get us there. The next giant telescope that NASA is planning to build, and which will take, you know, probably on the order of 20 years, but the name tells you everything you need to know. It's called the Habitable Worlds Observatory. And that shows you that the astronomical community is all in now on the search for astrophysical life, for life on alien worlds. And that was not the case even as close as 20 years ago.
To me, that is absolutely wild that we're living in that particular, in this timeline, in this era, isn't it?
People need to understand that, like, just like the question of life, the question of whether or not there were any other planets than the ones orbiting the sun was also goes back 2,500 years. They already were asking the question about whether there were other planets. And like Aristotle said, no, Earth is the only like hat planet that's possibly inhabitable. The atomists like Democritus were arguing that like, no, planets are everywhere and they're inhabitable. And that question also went on for 2,500 years until it was answered definitively in 1995. So even when I was in graduate school in the late 80s, you know, if you asked me whether or not there were planets, I'd be like, we think they're there, but we haven't found any. And we went from 1995 discovering the first planet orbiting a sun-like star to now we know that every star in the sky hosts a family of worlds. And if you count up five stars in the nighttime sky, one of them has a planet in the right place for life to form in that what we call the habitable zone.
You mentioned that JWST is just on the edge of making some of these findings and that telescope looking for habitable planets is going to get us closer to that. What is it looking for? What makes a planet habitable?
The first step for habitability is water. We believe that liquid water is an essential component for getting life started. And we have lots of reasons for thinking that, good reasons. Like, you know, people have considered other possibilities like ammonia and such. But water, you know, if you were starting from scratch and you were like, I need something that I can dissolve stuff in to get life's molecular shenanigans going, you'd be like, oh, water. So we're looking for planets that have liquid water on their surface. We're looking for planets that have atmospheres. We think, you know, without an atmosphere, you're not going to have life. So there's a variety of things that we think biochemistry requires. And this is what we're looking for when we look for life. So when we choose a habitable planet, our planet to focus our attention on, and that's what we're going to have to do, we're going to focus on planets that are in the habitable zone, that have atmospheres of the kind that we think are necessary. And, you know, like certainly, well, if we found oxygen, that would actually tell us that life was there. But, you know, and so temperatures, we're going to want to have the right temperatures, the pressures. And again, we're trying to be agnostic now. That also, one of the interesting things that has happened in the field is that that we are no longer only looking for Earth analogs. So there's a whole movement in the field to look at agnostic biosignatures. But we do think that things like the availability of energy, having the right kinds of molecular compounds to build the Lego blocks of molecular, you know, of biochemistry, no matter what kind of biochemistry it is, these are all the things that we're going to be looking for when we start the search. Now, you can ask also, what actually are we going to look for? What are we going to consider to be evidence for life? But that's kind of a different question.
Well, let me ask you that. What would you be looking for then? now you've got habitability. Now, what do you look for to find signs of life?
Yeah, so glad you asked. Great question. So going from habitable to inhabited, right? What we're going to be looking for are either biosignatures or technosignatures. So what exactly are those? One of the main ways we find exoplanets are when the planet passes between us and its star as it orbits the star. And when that happens, there's a little tiny eclipse, basically. A little bit of the light of the star is blotted out. And if the planet has an atmosphere, some of that starlight passes through the atmosphere and picks up a kind of spectral fingerprint of whatever is in the atmosphere, the compounds in the atmosphere. So, for example, recently the JWST just found really clear evidence for methane and carbon dioxide in a world. But so we can figure out things like, yeah, this world, this atmosphere definitely has methane and carbon dioxide. We've already done that. What are we looking for when it comes to life? Biosignatures are things like oxygen, because as far as we can tell, for most planets, certainly an Earth-like planet on an Earth-like orbit, the only way oxygen is going to get into the atmosphere, as it did on our planet, is because life puts it there. Oxygen is a byproduct of photosynthesis on the Earth. And if it wasn't for life, the oxygen would very quickly react back with all the rocks and everything and be gone. And we'd go back to just kind of a methane carbon dioxide atmosphere. So finding oxygen, finding dimethyl sulfide, which is stuff that plankton farts out. There's a whole list of things that we can say are signatures of there being a biosphere. But we can also ask about technosignatures, which would be the spectral imprint of things that only a technological civilization could put into the atmosphere or into the light from the planet. So, for example, city lights. There's been a couple of papers that have shown that if the planet had a lot of artificial illumination on the night side, that would leave a fingerprint in the light. We just did a recent paper that showed that chlorofluorocarbons, right, the stuff that is eating up the ozone layer, that also would have a very clear spectral fingerprint if some civilization, either by accident or on purpose, and there's reasons why you'd want to put CFCs in your atmosphere if they were in the atmosphere. So we just showed actually that the JWST, with like about 100 hours of observing time and some, you know, assumptions, would be able to see a planet like Earth with Earth levels of CFCs in it, which is really remarkable. So it's this idea of the atmospheric characterization, that's what we call it, is how we're going to find the first evidence for either a biospheres or what we call technospheres.
So you're essentially looking for pollutants and plankton fart. That will be the data that says that there's life there, huh? Fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that's some of it, right? There's other things. I mean, people are hard at work. So I'm the principal investigator on NASA's first grant ever to study technosignatures from alien worlds, from exoplanets. So our job is to come up with a library, basically, of all the different possibilities of ways in which a technological civilization could leave imprints that are detectable in their light.
Because of the distances, though, I mean, we'd be seeing a alien society in its past, or is this something that, you know, we would be able to communicate with these cosmic neighbors at this point?
The telescopes we have right now, we're going to be able to look out to, you know, somewhere on the order of 100 or a couple of 100 light years and make those kinds of detections. I think it may be a little bit further, but it's not going to be wildly further, which means we're only looking 100, you know, we're looking 100 years in the past. Right, or a couple hundred years in the past. Hopefully they're still there. But, you know, communications, you send a message being like, yo, what's up? And then 200 years later or 400 years later, you get like, hey, who are you? You know, so the whole communication thing, and that's really the people have to understand the big difference between the classic SETI, the ideas that were like in the movie Contact, say, and the way we're thinking now. You know, SETI, the classic SETI with the radio telescopes was very much in the beginning, not so much now, but in the beginning was very much about interstellar communications. You send them a message, we send that, you know, we get one back. But the new way of doing it, which is why I don't even really like to use the word SETI anymore. I think the field should be called technosignatures, of which the classic methods, you know, the things, the amazing things that, like, say, the Breakthrough Listen are doing, you know, that's just one piece. And the atmospheric technosignatures, really what we're doing is it's a cosmic stakeout. We're like detectives, you know, sitting in our cars, you know, with our cold coffee and our crappy donuts, and we're just watching. We don't need anybody to be like building a beacon to send us messages. We can just watch civilizations go about their business of civilizationing, or biospheres just being biospheres. So it's a radical departure from the way that people sort of thought SETI, you know, or this whole project had to work.
And finally, Adam, you know, when this data, if it comes back as it being pretty certain that there is some sort of society on these planets out there, are folks outside the science community going to even believe it? And how do you go about telling that, this groundbreaking message that we are not alone anymore?
I think, you know, I don't think it has to be societies. I think the detection of a biosphere would be one of the most important, not only scientific discoveries that was ever made, but one of the most important discoveries in the human history. Because people have this, sometimes people ask me, like, you know, will everybody freak out? Will, like, society go mad? You know, it's like, no, it's not going to go mad. But it's going to rewire how we understand ourselves in the universe. It's not just going to be something that just passes on and people are like, oh yeah, whatever. Because, you know, I have a great example of another astronomical discovery that reshaped human history, and that was the Copernican Revolution, right? Before Copernicus, everybody, educated people, woke up and said, oh, look, the sun's rising. 200 years after, or 100 years after Copernicus, everybody woke up and said, oh, look, it just looks like the sun is rising. The horizon's actually going down, right? And that was just an astronomical realization that the Earth was not the center of the universe. It was just another planet going around the sun. But, you know, the Copernican Revolution is intimately connected with the Renaissance, with the Enlightenment, with the Protestant Reformation, right? I mean, it just wholly and completely reshaped how we thought of ourselves. And knowing that we were not, that life, us, are not an accident, are not a one-off that just happened in one place, but that in fact we were part of a cosmic community of life would really wire what we think we are and our relationship to life on the planet.
Fascinating stuff. The book is The Little Book of Aliens. Adam Frank, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you, Brandon. This is a really great conversation.
That was Adam Frank, an astrophysicist and author of The Little Book of Aliens. That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Subscribe on NPR One, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or wherever you get your podcasts. We've got more space coverage online. Visit WMFE.org/space. Are We There Yet? Is a production of 90.7 WMFE News. Our producer is Marian Summerall. Editorial guidance from LaToya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet? Comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.